The race is on, but only under safety car conditions and 2.25 hours late, with the Belgian Grand Prix reduced to 3 laps under the safety car and Max Verstappen taking the easiest victory of his career. I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to discuss how it all played out and how the Spa weekend still produced some winners and losers are Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes. Well, Mark, this is one you've been at base for. Did you know something about the weather forecast before you let me and Scott come out?
Absolutely, yeah. I could see which way this was going. It was obvious. This was going to be the first time in F1 history that there weren't any racing laps at all. It was just so obvious. And yeah, that's why I sat it out.
Well, it's been quite good being here. It's certainly been an interesting experience. And actually, Scott, you were enjoying the intrigue and the interest, weren't you? Except when you suddenly lost motivation at one point.
Yeah, I did have sort of like a mid-excitement dip. I should point out, at no point was I obviously like reveling in the terrible situation that other people found themselves in, especially the fans that were trackside. I did. I know it sounds disingenuous, especially when drivers always say just like, oh, you know, the fans this, the fans that. But I just think like every single person that was sat in the media centre basically at some point had just like this enormous pang of sympathy, because you just see these people, like these truly hardy souls that are out there. You know, bad enough the ones that I could see across from the pit lane building sitting in the grandstand, but the people that we could see TV pictures of standing around the place and just getting soaking wet and or sitting in there sort of like whatever they've got like pulled over them to try and stay dry. I did feel just enormous sympathy for them, and they're the real losers out of what happened here. But just in terms of being here for a unique experience, being here for something that was unprecedented, something that is almost certainly never going to happen again in Grand Prix history, to actually be here for it, to see it unfold, to try and work out what was going on and the different sort of regulatory implications of things, how things were going to be worked out, not really knowing what was going to happen next, there was absolutely an element of fascination about it that I did enjoy.
Yeah, I have to say, I've said for many years that one day this was going to happen, but even when it did finally happen, I couldn't quite believe it. But I have to say, if there's any of you listening to this who are in the crowd, I salute you. You are hardy souls, and I hope you got dry and warm later on. There was tremendous determination from those watching, and I can only apologise on behalf of F1 for the fact there wasn't a serious race, but there was plenty to talk about, so hopefully we're going to be able to pick through some of the intrigue. So let's get into it. Well, Mark, we did have a race. The result was declared after one lap, officially. Even your capacity for drawing out fascinating unseen details will have given you nothing to work with on this one. So I'll just quickly remind everyone of the results. Max Verstappen first, George Russell second, and Lewis Hamilton third. But the key question is, should this really be considered a race and points, or rather half points, awarded?
No, of course not. There's a certain regulatory framework that the commercial terms are paid out on, and which defines what a race is. And fine, you can tick those boxes, but as to whether it's just a complete joke to consider it was a race. It was, you know, some laps behind a safety car. That's all that happened. It doesn't really need spelling out. I think the implications of it are being very eloquently pointed out by Lewis Hamilton, as ever, you know, the most articulate for any injustices. But as he points out, it's obvious we couldn't race. It was just way too dangerous for that track and those conditions. But the fact that we did those laps under the safety car to satisfy the commercial terms, to make sure that F1 got paid, that's contractually, you know, okay, is one thing. But morally, what about the poor fans that have paid money to be there and stood in the rain and supported F1 while it didn't do anything? It didn't give them a race. Shouldn't they be compensated? Shouldn't they have their money paid back, essentially? And I think that's a very difficult point to argue against from a commercial viewpoint, from a moral viewpoint rather than a commercial one.
But Scott, from what you heard from some of the key players, commercial concerns were nothing to do with it, were they?
Yeah, apparently it's just a massive coincidence and convenience that we got enough safety car running to just tip over the 3 laps completed by the race leader to be able to award half points and get a race result log, which, how fortunate considering they weren't aiming for it to get that, you know, the commercial stuff to make sure that everything, every box was ticked in that regard, that's just worked out very conveniently for Formula One, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's what I didn't like. It was a box ticking exercise. It wasn't a Grand Prix, and I'd have much rather it was abandoned without it being a race at all. And obviously, I'd rather there was a race, but what we had was not a race. And other sports do this. I've been to cricket matches that have been rained off entirely, and you get your refund. Or if there's only a certain number of overs play, you get a partial refund. And certainly, we didn't get many overs in this Grand Prix, so at the very least, a partial refund. But I agree with Lewis Hamilton.
If there'd been overs in this Grand Prix, I'd have understood it less than I normally do, because obviously my cricket knowledge, as you often mock me for, is at a bare minimum. But I think my issue with sort of how it's been handled, from this insistence that there wasn't a commercial element to it, is that it constantly just comes across as disingenuous and borderline patronising. Because to just say, I do understand the point that this is the sort of thing that can happen. If you buy a ticket to a sporting event, there are sometimes conditions, circumstances that mean you don't see what you're paying to see. But to then come out and just say, like so for example, Stefano Domenicali said, first of all, we put the emphasis on the promoter, said, you know, it's not F1 that handles the ticket. So basically saying, you guys make the first move, and then sort of describing it as, oh, we could, you know, we should give the fans the attention they deserve. It's kind of like, well, that's just words and they don't really mean anything. Are you going to give these people a refund or not? I mean, they've sat through a wet F3 race, a Porsche Supercup race, which I know, like, that's what everyone here came for. The Grand Prix is just a sideshow to the Porsche Supercup. But they have just sat through that, which they've sat through hell for that. And there has to... I feel like if you're going to do something like this, and you're going to do something so obviously for you to get your own money to tick your boxes, you have to offer something back to the fans. I'm not saying that's necessarily a full refund, but there's got to be something they can do, isn't it? And some kind of gesture of goodwill would make an awful lot of sense, and be the only, and just simply be the right thing to do. It's not even about posturing; it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, I'd agree with that completely. I mean, some will have bought tickets for the whole weekend, and they've had their Friday and Saturday, so you can legitimately say they've had some of their value. But it's just about building loyal customers, as it were. If you want to talk in the commercial terms, these are your customers. You need to look after them. They show devotion to you. So look after them. We have to see how it all plays out, though. But yeah, for me, from a purely racing perspective, it'll go down the record books as a Grand Prix win. Drivers will have scored points and got results, but it's not really a proper Grand Prix by any means. Many drivers said that they felt they shouldn't have been points awarded. Sebastian Vettel was critical. Pierre Gasly said he didn't like it. So there were plenty of drivers who agree with that. But we should say, Mark, Max Verstappen did turn in a really excellent pole lap to win this. We'll get on to the other standout performer later, but it's not Max Verstappen's fault that the race circumstances were this way. He was the one who got pole position. He nailed it on Saturday. So he earned the right to be in the position to benefit from the weird situation. And who knows, he'd probably taken off in the wet race and won anyway.
Oh, absolutely. It's no one's fault. It's just the situation it found itself in. It's just a question of what you do once you found yourself in that situation. And no, Max did the job in qualifying. And I suspect that had the race gone ahead, had there been a wet race, we couldn't have raced like that. It would have been carnage. Somebody would have got hurt or worse. But had there been a wet race, I suspect he would have dominated it. They were going backwards and forwards with them wing levels on the Red Bull throughout the weekend, and they trimmed it right out in practice three. But then it stuck the wing back on in for qualifying. So they had a lot of downforce on the car. Mercedes were running a low downforce setup. George Russell's Williams was somewhere in between. And I suspect that in a wet race, Max would have just disappeared. Nobody would have seen which way he'd gone. So, yeah, I don't think that there was any particular look about Max getting maximum points. He was the quickest guy out there this weekend.
And I imagine Max Verstappen would have loved to race. In fact, he was saying he wanted to race, of course, with the advantage of the visibility privilege of the leader. So slightly difficult for everyone else behind him. But he'd have loved to have won it the right way, just as every driver would have done. But he gained that position on merit. I think we also have to stress just how difficult those conditions were. I say difficult, it's not even difficult. Daniel Ricciardo was talking about this after the race very eloquently, as he usually does, and just hitting the point in that he says there's a point where the rain level gets up to a point where it's not about skill, it's just about pure luck, and just the car just can't handle it. So it's very easy to say, oh, well, in the old days they dealt with it. But realistically, you can see why they were being extremely cautious, particularly at this sort of circuit, because where's the skill in if you literally cannot drive the car, if you cannot see? We've seen some terrible accidents at Spa over the past few years, so we just don't want that situation. So is anybody joining the queue to condemn the drivers for being cowards or some of the more leery social media complaints?
No. I also think that the visibility point is super important as well. You could see it when they're behind the safety car, how much spray is getting kicked up. And more than once, Max Verstappen ended up quite close to the safety car, just because obviously when you're trying, it's hard enough behind the safety car, obviously just making sure you do your keeping your brakes and tires in some kind of temperature window, and then obviously accelerating, braking, the safety car is only running at a certain speed. Trying to do all that when conditions are difficult, when you know the safety car is should we say moving around a little bit in its own right, you know, keeping that thing on track and trying to go at a sensible enough speed is very, very difficult. But then obviously the drivers, Max Verstappen as the leader of the pack, is then obviously trying to do his own thing behind that while also trying to see where he's going, and then everyone behind him is just in this massive wall of spray and you just can't see anything. You would see like television pictures where out of some corners you can't see the car behind because of the spray. What do you think the view is like when you're actually in the cockpit itself? So it was just a race that was just at no point looked like it was going to happen for safety reasons, because ultimately it's easy to say that in the past races would have been held in these conditions or worse conditions, but the fact is now we do have slightly odd wet tires. I think they only work in a very narrow range. Aquaplaning is super easy. These cars are I'm just going to describe them as just weird racing cars as well. They don't react like just sort of conventional racers, even conventional single seaters or conventional Formula One cars, or what the idea of a conventional Formula One car is, because it just becomes so trick. And then if you put it into all that none of the drivers can see anything, it's a recipe for disaster, especially at a track like this, where you don't even need conditions like this to have massive, massive accidents and people piling into one another. So that's why I think it was actually handled very clumsily at times. But the broader overall position of we never went racing was the sad outcome, but it was the right outcome.
Let's get into that in a little bit more detail, Scott. F1 race director Michael Masi was in the unenviable position of being in charge of it all. Do you think he got those key decisions right in terms of the initial delay with those formation laps and then the brief spell under the safety car later on to tick off those necessary laps?
Well, I don't think there's a clear-cut answer, just because I think certain parts of it were handled correctly. I don't think the overall process was handled as well as it could have been. And there were some parts that were just handled badly. It exposed a lot of shortcomings with the F1 FIA regulations, and it also exposed the mastery that the FIA has on those regulations. You know, we heard, for example, Red Bull having to contest the FIA and Michael Massey's interpretation that Sergio Perez wouldn't be allowed to take the restart if Red Bull could get his car repaired on time, because he'd had outside assistance getting back to the garage after his reconnaissance lap shunt. But Red Bull pointed out, well, there's nothing in the rules that say you can't do that. You can't get the outside assistance during the Grand Prix, but there's nothing before then. And then Massey basically said, I'll check that and get back to you. And then actually it turned out Perez could take the restart had the car been fixed in time, and obviously we went racing properly. So that's kind of... I accept that the regulations don't explicitly state anything there, but they don't state it either way. And yet Massey came back with a very definitive answer when he was first asked about it and said, no, he can't take the start. And then realised he was wrong and corrected. That's the race director not being in total command of that situation, which again, as I say, shows a shortcoming. And then just procedural stuff like this run of delays, for example. And then you get into this murky situation we had during the lengthy red flag period, where people are questioning how many laps have been officially completed, because people are the suggestion being that no laps have completed, but actually officially every time you had an official race delay start, that takes one lap off the total, which makes, in practical terms, is just, I understand it from a time point of view, I guess you sort of say, okay, 5 minutes is roughly worth one lap, so we'll take that away, but that just seems such an arbitrary way of doing it. So it's just really kind of messy from start to finish. And then at the end, they say it was a legitimate attempt to go racing. The FIA and even the teams apparently saw a gap in the radar that said, on the weather radar, that said actually there was a little window coming, which is that's when they made the decision to go for it. But then in the time it took to actually get things going again, because it's a 10-minute warning, by the time they then went out on track, the rain was falling harder than it was when they made that decision, and it got worse again. I want to believe that there was a genuine attempt to get the racing going, and I do think they did everything within the various powers that the FIA stewards have and that the race director has to try and manage this as well as possible. It was a very difficult one to manage. There was some stuff they did well, but I can't help but shake the feeling that this ultimately it was all about a box ticking exercise, as you put it. And then that ultimately kind of makes the way they handled it at the end disappointing. It's impossible to prove whether they did genuinely do it with the intent of going racing again. But I think that's part of the whole problem, isn't it? It's not massively transparent. The whole thing was a bit murky. At best, it was messily handled. At worst, it was actually handled quite cynically. So it obviously depends on what side of the divide you sit.
But Mark, do you think there was ever any point where it was possible to get a race off? The drivers said the best of the conditions were on the reconnaissance laps. Obviously, when they did run under the safety car, it was even worse than it had been earlier when they did those early formation laps. But was there any window they could have hit?
No, not from what I could see, just from on screen. But I think maybe if we'd... we've got the weather forecast. Maybe if we'd restructured the whole weekend and got the race underway early in the morning, maybe. I don't know. It's a bit like Suzuka 2014, when we knew the bad weather was coming and there was thought given to starting the race a couple of hours early. But it was deemed to be too difficult because you couldn't tell the people that had bought the tickets in time, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know. I mean, you were there on the ground and I wasn't, so I don't know whether there is anything there earlier, but certainly from what I saw from that time at 3 p.m. right the way through to when it was declared several hours later, no, it didn't look like that was a feasible at any point. Did that look like a feasible racetrack?
The only opportunity they'd have had to have done it would have been to do what sort of Mark was outlining there's precedent for and shift the whole thing forward. But Stefano Domenicali says that was never considered an option, because when everybody was looking at the weather forecast for today, it looked like, in to quote Domenicali, normal rain. So manageable weather. And you kind of, and I guess their position was that you can't change an entire schedule on the basis of there will be a bit of rain at some point. I'm obviously, that's a slightly flippant way of viewing it, because it has been raining extremely heavily at times all weekend. It's been a nightmare. And every time you go outside, it's like the weather turns every 2 or 3 minutes. The phrase fickle Ardenne weather has never been more true than of whenever someone's tried to dash into the paddock. So maybe they should have, maybe they could or should have looked at that and said, actually, do you know what? We need to give ourselves the biggest window possible. So we are rescheduling it, and the race is going to have a scheduled start time now of midday or something. But obviously that has further knock-on implications for the F3 and Super Cup support races. The promoter has to notify ticket holders. People have to get in. There was already some traffic chaos this morning because a bunch of the car parks that are based on fields and on mud, basically, had flooded because of so much rain. So there was already difficulties. I think it was just a very, very unfortunate set of circumstances.
Yeah, well, Formula One doesn't control the weather. That is absolutely true. And it's just one of those things that the weather was very, very bad throughout today. It brightened up a little bit kind of around midday, and then it got back into just being wall-to-wall grey and rain. So, yeah, just one of those things in that regard. Well, Mark, inevitably, F1 doesn't want this to happen again. As always, we have questions from our The Race Members Club members. So Oscar asks, what should be done in situations like the one encountered today? What does F1 need to do to be able to race successfully in the wet, given that climate change may well lead to more wet races?
Yeah, it's a very good point. The weather that we've seen at Spa this weekend is actually a whole lot less extreme than it they saw there a few months ago, when it was mudslides and it was causing damage to buildings, and lots of people lost their homes and their lives. So yeah, this is not just a localized problem. This is a trend, and yeah, in terms of. It's very difficult to say. We reschedule Spa for a friendlier time in the year. It's like a little mini climate. It's always liable to have a heavy rainfall. I think you'd have to look at making the cars more raceable in extreme weather, so that would imply higher ride heights. It did occur to me that the 2022 generation of cars would be interesting to see how a 2022 generation of car would have handled this, because the whole idea of those cars, behind the whole concept, is to make the aerodynamic wake less disruptive, and it's doing that by throwing up the air much higher over the car behind. And I wonder if that would have made visibility better, because of the water's going the same way as the air. So that we might find that the 2022 generation of car doesn't create such awful visibility as these ones. And that was the main problem. It wasn't so much standing water. Most of the drivers were saying, actually, the surface was okay. The surface was perfectly raceable. It was just the visibility. And, George is saying, well, above 200 kilometers per hour, about 125 miles an hour, you literally might as well just close your eyes. You might as well just driven up the straight with your eyes closed. So that's just not a very flexible racing car in terms of road racing and in terms of encompassing all the different weather conditions we might meet. So yeah, I think it should be factored in to the future specifications of the cars. But let's see where we are as a starting point with the 22 cars, because I suspect they might already be significantly better in that respect.
Yeah, we can hope on that one. I think in terms of what we're preventing, the areas where they can clearly improve are the things that don't allow the race to happen, but improving the communication of what's going on. It wasn't great to the TV audience, was it, in terms of exactly what the delays were and the decisions that were being made. I don't know what it was like for those watching trackside. If anyone was, find me a tweet on EdgeDrawF1 at Twitter to let me know if actually you were getting decent announcements and updates on the situation. That'd be interesting to know. But there's little things there that can be done. But yeah, fundamentally, it's about what the cars are like in those conditions. But they can certainly take a little bit of a look at the rules and make an improvement. We've also got a fun question from Paul Semnocker, who asks, seeing the treacherous conditions, has there ever been a situation where the safety car has gone off track? A slightly left-field question, but we have occasionally seen ones, haven't we, Mark? Interlagos 2002, Heidfeld hit the medical car door, didn't he? Not quite safety car crashing, but Sid Watkins opened the door, Heidfeld and the Sauber took it off. That was one that springs to mind.
Yeah, and there was how the medical cars and the safety cars do the reconnaissance laps earlier in the weekend. There was, I think it was 2000, Alex Ribeiro crashed the medical car very heavily at Monaco, just went off at Tabac, I think it was, and crunched the front against the wall. But actually, the safety car losing control whilst leading the pack, no, I don't think that's ever happened.
Yeah, pretty unlikely. There was the Inouye incident at Monaco in 95, wasn't there, where Philippe Bogalski in a course car hit his arrows while it was being recovered, and because of the way it was being towed and the impact, it ended up flipping. Thankfully, Inouye was wearing his helmet. So we've got a few safety/course/medical car mishaps there, but not quite a full-on situation where they've gone off track. They do, of course, and this is something that isn't often seen, do quite a few practice laps during the weekend. Plus, they have properly accomplished drivers as well, so you don't generally see those mistakes. But Scott, coming back to the matter at hand, we talked about this pressure on Michael Masi during the 4-hour attempt to run the race. Tamara Salter says, the biggest takeaway for me today was the lack of clarity of the rules and the different interpretations that the teams had. Even Red Bull seemed to know the rules better than Michael Masi. Can the rules be made clearer so there's no ambiguity? You mentioned the Perez situation. In fact, that was my reading of the rules at the time, that Jonathan Wheatley at Red Bull was absolutely correct. But how much of the problem is, in fact, in the way the rules are presented and the gaps in the rules?
Yeah, there are always things that pop up where you and I will say to one another, well, that's just badly written. That's a badly written regulation. So that does inherently cause some confusion. I do think the difficult nature of today and some of the stuff that was being dealt with meant there was a lot of trying to work out scenarios that happen so rarely that there isn't the same level of sort of intuition with dealing stuff. So I understand that. I can understand why that can be a little bit clumsy. But I do think there is an absence of transparency, and there needs to be a better way it's trying to project some of this information across to the viewer, because the things that, like we were saying, why is there a discussion over whether the race has officially started? Why is there debate over has the 3-hour race window actually opened? What impact does the fact that the formation lap began under the safety car have? How many laps have actually got to still be completed in the race? How many laps have you taken off the total race duration? Like, these are questions that it's completely right and fair to ask them in this situation, because there are all sorts of regulations dictating this, but the answers should be given, and they should be given simply. They should be given in ways that are easy to understand and quickly as well. As soon as these regulations are there, written in black and white, so it's not like someone has to try and work out what it is. You just need to either know it or quickly find it and tell people what they need to know. I understand that that's sometimes the job of the commentator. That's the job that we have, because we broadcast information to fans on social media. So we were doing the best job we can. But F1 and the FIA know this stuff. So it's their responsibility to be trying to get as much of it across as clearly as possible. But I think the real area in this where the rules aren't fit for purpose, and that I think cause a lot of division and there is definitely ambiguity, is on the whole half point situation. Because a lot of people I could see were asking, because you mentioned it earlier, how could we have satisfied the rule of completing more than two laps and therefore qualifying for half points being awarded when the race classification was based at the end of lap one? The race classification clearly shows that only one lap was completed in this Grand Prix. So how do you square the two? And this is because there are two different regulations governing two separate areas that say that command two different things. One being the article of the sporting regulation, which I believe is Article 6.5, which is the one that just simply specifies more than two laps need to be completed by the race leader for 50% points to be awarded. Now, in the FIA's view, that happened. That unquestionably happened, because Max Verstappen came into the pits at the end of his third lap, and because he crossed the control line, even though it was under a red flag and the race was being suspended, he crossed the control line, it ticked over to a third lap completed, that was it. Three laps completed, three is more than two, 50% points can be awarded. But because the race didn't resume and it finished under a red flag, under a suspension, there's a mechanism separate in the rules, I think it's like Article 51 or something like that, where it outlines how you calculate the final classification in that situation. And that is done, I'm not going to say in the really complicated way it's done, it's specified in the sporting regulations. It's basically, it goes back two laps. So in this case, the race had been completed over three laps, but you go back to the end of lap one to determine the final classification. In the FIA's view, those two things are separate. Just because the final classification says only one lap was completed doesn't mean that actually only one lap was completed. Now, there's clearly a contradiction there, and you can interpret it different ways. But the point is, the FIA says that the number of laps that the final classification shows doesn't have to determine the number of laps that Article 6.5 is governed by. So that's how you end up in this situation where three laps were completed, but the results only say one lap was completed. I don't agree with the FIA's interpretation. I think that is needlessly confusing. I think that is a needless disconnect. But I'm not the one in charge, which, while sometimes I feel like I might make better decisions, probably overall for F1, it's better that I'm not in charge.
It's easier to be the critic, isn't it? But no, you've got a very good point there. And I'd say, Mark, quite a few drivers suggested that maybe because points weren't really worthy of what happened, there should be some kind of rule that demands it's X number of green flag laps or something like that. Would you be in favour of something along those lines? Maybe raise the number a bit and stipulate that at least there has to be some proper active racing of substance, because can't do anything about the weather, but it would be a shame if we had another Grand Prix that was like this again, wouldn't it?
Yeah, there has to be some actual racing for points to be given out. That's just ludicrous that you get points for circulating behind the safety car. I mean, that doesn't need to be spelled out. That's just obvious. But that's not how it is. So I actually, going back to what Scott said, I actually see where the distinction between the number of laps completed and the number of laps that the results are determined by, that disconnect, I can see where that comes from. That it's an unintended consequence of the regulation that's there on countback, so that when there's been carnage and the race has to be stopped, and you need to go back to when it was, you know, actually properly a race before everybody aquaplaned off and the results were just, you know, random. You need to have a mechanism where you can do a countback, and then it's typically stated as two laps. So yeah, I can get that, and that's how this is being applied here. But as Scott said, it's unnecessarily complicated, and it should really be simple. If you haven't actually had a race, there shouldn't be any points handed out.
Well, one of the problems is, I guess, and I'm not going to defend them too much on this, but obviously those regulations weren't written with the idea that a three-lap Grand Prix would ever take place, would it?
So yeah, exactly.
So this combination of things, it is just rare. But it has happened. It shows it can happen. And as McLaren boss Zak Brown said, he did a video on his personal Twitter addressing fans, says F1 has now had this situation, and it's F1's responsibility now to sit down, review this, and work out, right, we need to install a proper contingency plan, because clearly what we have in place, when this freak event does occur, it's not good enough. So let's make sure we've got something better, because something's been exposed by this.
No, he's absolutely right. And obviously, Zak Brown's a sharp commercial mind as well, so he knows what it means for the perception of F1 and the value of F1 to have things like this happening. So it's an important one, and it's very clear that there needs to be some changes made to the sporting regulations. But we should address the impact of what happened, Mark. The race has closed up the World Championship battle. Verstappen's now 3 points behind Hamilton and Red Bull 7 behind Mercedes in the Constructors' Championships, but there are potentially wider implications. Yannis van der Waal asks, to what extent does this benefit Red Bull or Mercedes that this race isn't raced, though half points are awarded? In hindsight, a benefit for Verstappen is the mileage on the engine he has, with no new ones, is limited, and it's beneficial for everyone in terms of the cost cap.
I think probably Red Bull would have signed up to this at the start of the weekend. We'll only know at the end of the season who it's really benefited, won't we?
Yeah, that's very, very true. It's you can often only do these in reverse. But yeah, obviously, whoever won this race was always going to feel advantaged a little bit by it, but ultimately Verstappen might well have been up there. It was a little bit of a surprise, because actually you'd say if it was going to be a wet conditions qualifying based race win, you'd say Lewis Hamilton was well set for that, because he's turned in so many stunning wet qualifying laps. Struggled a little bit for grip, although he was still over 2 seconds faster, I think, than Valtteri Bottas in Q3, so he was not exactly hanging around. But one thing we should talk about, because we talked about him tangentially, Scott, is Sergio Perez. His future was confirmed during the Spa weekend. He will be with Red Bull next year. No big surprise there. But do you think he could have marked the occasion in a much more disastrous manner?
struggling to think of one. No, I sort of joked when the Grand Prix, I think, was probably still happening. Well, such that it can be called a Grand Prix. Sergio Perez has done an excellent job in a race with no racing, with only 3 laps under the safety car, to turn whatever it was, 7th on the grid, into finishing, well, I guess it would have been, 18th or 19th at the back. That's a pretty impressive feat for a race with no racing and the order defined by, the finishing order defined by where you should have started.
Yeah, he was 19th in the end because Lance Stroll got a penalty for a change of rear wing assembly. But Mark, regardless of the unfortunate incident on the reconnaissance lap, when I imagine Sergio must have had a very, very painful few seconds as he slid towards that barrier, do you think it's the right move from Red Bull?
Don't know. I'm waiting to see how he gets on the rest of this season and reducing that deficit to max. I'm not altogether confident he'll do that. But as with Daniel Ricciardo, they have the reset of the 2022 cars coming up, and I suspect that that will help him, and that the car is developed in a direction, the Red Bull has developed in a direction which, you know, he's come in from the outside cold in, and it doesn't really suit. It's a very demanding drive. And I think the format of the cars for 2022 will not, those traits are, I don't think, will be there. So I think in a more conventional car, let's say, a car which drives more conventionally, I suspect you'll be able to reduce that. It is quite a yawning chasm at the moment in terms of his qualifying pace. And by the time, typically, I mean, forget this weekend, but typically when he qualifies 6th or 7th behind a Charles Leclerc or a Lando Norris, you know, in guys in slower cars, yes, he will eventually get past them in the race. But by the time he's done that, Verstappen and Hamilton have checked out and are 20, 25 seconds up the road. So that's, you know, that's not really, from his point of view, that's very, very disappointing. In terms of Red Bull's perspective, they just want a solid number two who will bag the points and who will be there if there's some misfortune falls upon Max, which, you know, he showed in Baku that he's perfectly capable of doing that. And he's several times been in the window that's prevented Mercedes from doing a second stop and trying to attack Max that way. So that for Red Bull, yes, he's sort of doing the job just about adequately. And given that the difficulties they've had filling that role with Gasly and Albon, I think they prefer just to concentrate on Max and know that they've got a sort of reliable, semi-reliable number two there. But Max, I'm sure aspires to be a lot more than that. And at the moment, he's barely fulfilling the Red Bull part of the expectation, let alone his own higher levels of expectation.
Yeah, I don't think Red Bull really had any alternatives at this stage. I did ask Perez about the hopes for next year, and he said, yeah, the new car, he's hopeful that being there from the ground floor of the new project will help, that a driver of his experience couldn't really do a great deal jumping into the last year of a kind of car development program. But Perez knows it's been a very, very chastening season for him, hasn't he? We know how good Perez can be. But the trouble is, you have the absolute great drivers, and Verstappen is unquestionably one of them. And then you have very, very, very good drivers like Perez, but sometimes they can kind of fall out of the window or be in difficult situations where it doesn't work. So let's hope he gets back in the window, because he is a really, really fine performer when he can. Scott, amazingly, you seem to have had some feedback from the crowd that we asked for before we've even released this podcast.
Yeah, everyone's massively, obviously, on the ball. So I can understand that. Yeah, I won't out this person by name, because obviously I don't know if they're comfortable with that. But I have had a few messages from people, most in public, just sort of people who were attending, saying that, you know, they how horrible this experience has been. But one fan who's was at the track a message to say they feel completely robbed after the whole experience, and especially Stefano Domenicali's statement at RE Refunds has made them livid. They say, my partner, my brother and I have paid a significant amount of money to attend this event, and for the prospect of a refund to be dismissed on a whim like that is extremely maddening. I'm sorry, I'm just venting, but I've waited over a year and a half for this event. And I honestly, I say this with total sincerity, my heart genuinely goes out to people like that, because I know from, not from an experience quite like this, but I know what it's like when you invest a lot of money in something that is meant to be special. It's meant to be something that you enjoy, and when that gets taken away from you, and then when you also get treated like a commodity afterwards, and you don't get any kind of recompense for what you've lost, that it's cruel in a way, and it's horrible. You know, especially, I'm sure there will be people who came here on a weekend ticket, and they've had a whole event and stuff like this, but there will also be people who came here one day. And even the people who have come here for the event, it's a huge undertaking to go to a Grand Prix, and there are people that don't live, shall we say, within an hour's drive of Spa that have come to this race. You've got Brits coming over here, people coming from all parts of Europe. Massive financial undertaking. And then to sit through this is insulting in its own way. But then to hear afterwards, effectively, words that say, well, you know, this is what you get sometimes, so you know, like it or lump it, that's it. That is even more insulting. So I can't express my sympathy with these people in the right terms, really, to do justice to what they've had to sit through, because it is massively unfair.
Yeah, they're completely right. And we've got to add the fact that people have not been able to go to things for a long time. The past 18 months have been difficult for everyone. So these events will be kind of even more of a thing to look forward to and enjoy, and to have it kind of taken away from you. I'd expect a bit better from F1, to be quite honest, just in terms of their tone and public messaging. They're talking about expanding the sport, bringing in new fans. Well, if you can't look after your existing fans, and that's not through any kind of serving the hardcore and not worrying about the rest of the world, that's just basic customer service and decency, really, isn't it? Just need to do a little bit better. It wasn't F1's fault the race couldn't happen, but they could have handled things a lot better. So yeah, thank you for that feedback. It's interesting to know how people are feeling about it, and I'm just very sorry to hear that it's been such a bad day for people. Well, Mark, there is a little bit more track action relevant to talk about. George Russell, we haven't talked about him. Second place in qualifying for Williams. That ensured there is a reason for this weekend to be remembered for what happened on track. That, of course, became second thanks to the not a race. But how exactly did he do that in a Williams?
It was an extraordinary performance. It was helped a little bit by just circumstance, but that car was... Well, I mean, he was saying that his strategist was saying that in the dry, they worked out that car was the 17th fastest on the grid. In the wet, it was probably a bit better than that. They'd put a bit of downforce on it, and the Alpines weren't working very well, and the Alphas weren't working. But it's probably only about the 10th or 12th fastest car there, and he's put it second on the grid. And partly it was because he did such a great job on the preparation lap, and he was able to do that ironically because the tire choice when they first went out in Q3, when he'd chosen wets, and it became obvious that he should have chosen inters, so he wasn't able to do what everybody else did, which was a push cool push lap. And everybody else that did push cool push found that their tires weren't fully up to temperature by the start of their second push lap. And George, because he'd done two push laps, one a sort of compromised one in terms of energy deployment, but push in terms of the tyres and the brakes, had his everything at the perfect temperature at the beginning of the lap. So he was able to have a car that was working pretty well at the beginning of the lap compared to, say, Verstappen and Hamilton. But he did an extraordinary job with it. And if you watch his in-car, the job that he did through Rouge, and it's a very tricky corner this year where the bump, there's a new bump where they've repaired the track from the mudslides, And in the wet, it's no longer flat. It's you get flat when you go in, but then it's a down change and a lift for quite a way up that hill. But his lift was very small, much smaller than Verstappen's. But partly because he had confidence that because he was the tires were there, but also just because it was very, very ballsy, and he absolutely had to do that to get a good straight line run down Lecom, because he was carrying a bit of downforce, not as much as the Red Bull, but more than the Mercedes. And that was it was half a second faster than anyone in sector one as a result of that. And then it was then really about not losing too much time, mainly to the Red Bull through sector two. And he was just absolutely fantastic through there. And he was just dancing that through, and in a beautiful, elegant way that he did it. And it was like poetry watching it. And that was it. It was just a stunning lap in a car that was working well, and a team that had made all the right calls. And it was just one of the all-time great qualifying laps.
Yeah, you have to put it down to that. And although obviously tremendously lucky to be able to get the second place, it comes from, same with Verstappen. He put it second, he got the second place thanks to circumstances. So it reflects the qualifying performance ultimately. But a great moment for Williams, and just reveals the class of George Russell. We talked a lot about how good he is. We had a question actually from Gordon Ross, which is, how do you think George Russell's achievement this weekend compares to Damon Hill's unexpected heroics in Hungary 97? That's quite a good question, because that's one of my favourite races. And Hill's performance in the Arrows was astonishing, qualifying third and all but winning, but just losing it out to a problem right near the end. In fact, you can listen all about that on our sister podcast, Bring Back V10s, Season 1, Episode 4, How Hill Nearly Won a Race for Arrows. So you can listen about that. But there were circumstances behind that. We know how good Hill was. The Bridgestone tyres were working brilliantly there, and he made the most of it. But I feel, just for sort of one sheer impact, I'd say probably, if we're comparing it, Russell's probably had something more to it, simply because Russell is also a driver on the way up, isn't he, Scott? You know, he's not a world champion as Damon Hill was there. He's got everything still, well, something still to prove anyway, not everything.
Yeah, I sort of said it's obviously he had the Sakhir Grand Prix where he stepped in at Mercedes and he almost beat Bottas to pole position, which was outrageous in its own right. And then, of course, he drove so amazingly in the race, and he should have won, not once, but twice. And that was a huge statement. But I actually think this eclipses that as a massive, I refer to it as a look at me moment. Just we know George's mega. We watch him pretty much week in, week out. We see stuff. But you only have to look at sort of how much criticism he gets for things that actually on surface level look worse than they are, to know that people don't always sort of see that so obviously. So to have that, this kind of just massive in your face thing in a Williams is just great currency for George. And I think I honestly think it will go down as, depending on your view, some people will view this as one of the great F1 qualifying performances. I certainly think it's one of, if not the most impressive underdog performances of this generation. I can't think of something that comes at you with such ferocity as this. There's things like Nico Hülkenberg's pole for Williams, obviously, but that was a fundamentally more competitive car, even if it was in mixed conditions, and he did a great job with that day. Giancarlo Fisichella's pole here, obviously, as well, stands out. But I just think for who George managed to overcome and how slow that Williams can be, yeah, this is just like this is one for the ages, basically, as a performance.
And on a related topic, Scott, Mercedes still hasn't officially announced its driver plans. Toto Wolff says a decision has been made. In fact, he said yes when asked that question multiple times. Why are they being so coy about it?
Because they haven't found an alternative. Because I guess they haven't tied up Valtteri Bottas' alternative. I was going to say they haven't found one for him. I think they have. I think it'll be Bottas to Alfa Romeo, and it's all going to be announced at Monza, because that makes sense, ties in with Alfa's home race. I'd be really so stunned now if it's Bottas for next year. I really like Valtteri. I think at his peak, he is a phenomenally fast driver, one of the fastest in F1. But I think his time has passed. I think his performances have gradually dipped as the season's gone on. I think George is going from strength to strength, and I don't know. Maybe it's easy to say this. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I just think if you were going to say that decision has been made, and it has been made in George's favour, Valtteri is on his way out, then those two drivers performed in qualifying in difficult conditions exactly the way you would expect them to if that decision has indeed been made that way. You know, George absolutely riding a crest of a wave, confidence at an all-time high, just going from strength to strength, loving what he's doing, loving showing people what he's doing. And Valtteri just wind out of his sails a little bit. He's now sort of, he's never going to phone it in, obviously, to the end of the season, but he knows that he's running out of time, basically, and he's counting down the days to his exit. And it sort of just had a sort of deflated air to it. The one caveat to that is obviously that VB has never been sort of particularly stunning in these conditions. He has struggled, in my recollection anyway, with Mercedes, always struggled to be quite so impressive. So maybe it's nothing to do with it, but that was just sort of my interpretation of what we saw.
The bottom line is Valtteri Bottas has had his shot in a great car for many years. We've seen what he can do. He's won races, done a great job. I was a great proponent of Bottas on the way up, but every driver, that there's a point where they kind of reach their peak and can't quite dig that little bit deeper and take the last step. And he's basically got to what you might call the second rung of a pretty high ladder. So that's been impressive. And now it's Russell's chance to, or Russell's time, rather, I should say, to prove that he can cut it week in, week out at the front of an F1 field. We haven't seen if he can do that week in, week out. We've seen a couple of glimpses, but that's hopefully the question that he will have the chance to answer with Mercedes. One quick question on another, almost the lost star, the forgotten star of the weekend, Mark, was Lando Norris. He reckoned he was a pole threat before he had that crash in Q3, very heavy accident. Battered him around a bit. He had an x-ray on his elbow to make sure there was nothing awry there. But he was absolutely flying before that, wasn't he? And if he had got pole, he'd have got a win.
Yeah, it's such a shame. He was absolutely flying. He was in contention for pole with a shadow of doubt. I mean, quickest in Q1, quickest in Q2. And he was just absolutely bursting to get at it at the beginning of Q3. You know, even though the conditions were very tricky, he was just absolutely, you know, on a wave. He was just pushing like crazy. Very, very confident. And then, yeah, just bit him. Just a little bit too hot into Rouge over that tricky little dip that I was talking about before. And, yeah, that was it. And thankfully, he was all he got was a sore elbow, because it was a very, very nasty-looking shunt.
Yeah, it was not a pleasant one. But, yeah, one of those weekends that just people who look at the results in the future won't realise quite how close he came. We should add Daniel Ricciardo had his best McLaren result, didn't he, in fourth place, having qualified fourth, obviously, because it wasn't a race. So good for him. But he never showed that Norris-like pace.
I like that you just said that as if it's a given that Ricciardo would have finished there. We've already been over this, Ed. Perez has proven that even in a race with no racing and no overtaking, you can still throw away a decent position.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's very sad for Sergio Perez. He'll have to be careful, or he'll end up inheriting Valtteri Bottas sympathy corner next year, won't he? So let's hope not.
No, that's true. Actually, the comment I just made me realise I wanted to give Nicholas Latifi a shout out for managing to turn whatever it was, 12th or 13th in qualifying, into a points finish in a race with no overtaking and three laps under the safety car, thanks to a combination of grid penalties and Perez binning it. So that's an amazing conversion from that qualifying spot, given what happened on Sunday.
Yeah, he jumped Perez and the penalty pair, Bottas and Norris. So that one was a fine achievement. But yeah, he's rumbling along nicely. Looks like he will definitely be at Williams next year. So second consecutive points finish for Nicholas Latifi. Well, thanks very much, Mark Hughes and Scott Mitchell. We found plenty to talk about, despite the fact that this wasn't really a race, no matter what the history books say. Head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen. There's still loads to read there. There won't be Mark Hughes' race analysis, but he shall be having a good look at some of the issues surrounding what went on with the race. I'll still do my driver ratings that will be 99.9% based on qualifying. I think you can probably guess which driver maybe damaged their rating a bit based on the race. And Scott Mitchell will be writing about why George Russell very much deserved that second place, despite the fact that obviously he didn't earn it in the race in any way. It's purely a qualifying achievement. So thanks very much for listening. We're now going to be turning our attention to Zandvoort and heading to the Netherlands, where we'll bring you everything you need to know about the Dutch Grand Prix.